The Tom Woods Show, episode 1185.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, learn the history and economics they kept from you over at libertyclassroom.com, my flagship site. Learn from me and from other folks you can trust all the stuff they left out. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com and grab yourself a coupon at libertyclassroom.com/coupons. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. We're talking today to an internet personality known simply as the Philosopher, but spelled P-H-O-L-O-S-O-P-H-E-R. So we're going to get to the bottom of why that is. But I thought this successful young woman in terms of social media reach, who has a lot of interesting things to say, would make for a good guest for a variety of reasons. But also her family background is quite interesting because they wound up coming to the United States after having fairly horrific experiences in no fewer than 3 Asian countries. So I thought it would be interesting to introduce you all to this internet personality if you do not know of her already. And let me just start right out with my first question. Let me start by asking about the name you use online, what's the origin of it? And secondly, why do you keep your true identity, you know, your superhero identity separate from your regular day-to-day identity? So to the point where people do not know who you are, actually.
Oh, good question. So the first question, which is where the name comes from, when I was thinking about starting a page where I could voice my thoughts and my philosophies, I was trying to think of a good and unique name. One of the first names I came up with, like, Philosopher's Apprentice. And then I was like, well, in the long term, I don't really want to be an apprentice. I was like, so that's not good. And then I was like, well, what are the things that I love the most? And one of them is philosophy and the other is pho. My mom cooked pho for me growing up, and that's like one of my favorite foods. I eat it all the time. So I combine pho and philosophy, and it just so happens to be pronounced the exact same. So that's where the name comes from.
And it's much, much better than Philosopher's Apprentice. That was a great decision you made. Your
Thank
instinct
you.
Was telling you this one isn't going to quite work. So,
yeah, exactly.
All right. So can I at least get roughly, you can even give me a range if you like, just so people could have a sense of a little bit more of where you're coming from, how old you are?
Sure. I am in my mid-20s.
Okay, so you are a youngster. All right, good. I like youngster stories.
I'm a quarter century now.
Yeah, oh, come on, that's nothing. Get out of here. So, but anyway, I like youngster
Compared
stories.
Compared to what, Tom?
Right. It's good to think like an economist. How did you ever have a period of your life when you were just a normie like everybody else and then suddenly, so what happened?
Yeah, totally. That started when I was in my 20s. So I went through public school my entire life. I even went to college for a little bit after dropping out after 3 years. But I was mostly a normie, you could say. I always had an affinity for liberty just because of my family history. And learning the story about how my family escaped 3 different wars and oppressive governments to finally be here. So I've always had a knack for that, but I would say I was on the sort of the leftist side. I thought that welfare was okay, you know, in moderation, and I would have liked Obama in office. I remember thinking he was a stand-up guy just because he was good at articulating himself, and it's just silly, you know, superficial things like that. So yeah, I was definitely a normie before my 20s. But what changed was I was in a long-term relationship, and the first exposure I got to the idea of philosophy, so even before voluntarism, was my boyfriend at the time showed me a video by Stefan Molyneux. And the first video was unrelated to even philosophy. It was just an hour-long like Bitcoin documentary. And to give you an example of how kind of normie I was like, oh my gosh, this guy just keeps talking for so long. he's so boring and he's just talking about facts about Bitcoin. This is so dry. And so that's kind of an example of how kind of superficial I was. But I started listening more to Stefan Molyneux's call-in shows where he has people call in. Specifically, I was interested in people talking about their personal relationships, relationships with families, struggles with communicating with family, healing past traumas and hurts. That really spoke to me because of my relationships with my family at the time. And that's what drew me in. And within the call-in shows, you hear things about why philosophy is so important, why searching for the truth and what is reality is better than living in falsehoods. And then also he talks about voluntarism. So that's kind of my beginning there. I was first drawn into voluntarism from and philosophy from a self-knowledge bent of wanting to learn about myself, improve myself, and resolve a lot of the traumas that I grew up with and heal a lot of the relationships that I had from my childhood, like with my family.
Well, I'm not going to pry into that, but I am curious when you say that your family fled oppressive regimes. Mm-hmm. Do you mind being specific?
Yeah. So from what I know, this is coming from my mom's side. I don't know much about my father's yet. I do want to ask him more. But from what I heard is my grandma, she was born in China and she saw her uncle die from starvation due to, I think there was the Sino-Japanese War. I'm pretty sure that's what my family's referring to because my mom mentioned that it's like a battle between the Chinese government and the Japanese government around the 1940s. So when I looked it up, I found Sino-Japanese War. So they escaped. My grandma left with her parents to Cambodia, you know, looking for freedom, trying to settle there. That's when she met, you know, my mom's dad. And so they lived there for a little bit, started their own business with like noodles. They made noodles. Go figure, right? I love pho. And eventually things got oppressive with the Khmer Rouge. And my mom has said that word specifically, so I know it was them. And things were getting oppressive. They alluded to there being racism against Chinese and Vietnamese people, which my family is, well, my mom's side is Chinese, but they somehow picked up Vietnamese along the way. I don't exactly know how. It could just be they met Vietnamese friends or something. But anyway, so they escaped Cambodia, but sadly some things happened where what would be my aunt or my grandma's, one of my grandma's daughters was murdered in front of my family and her own family, her husband and her kids by the Khmer Rouge. And they had to escape on foot to Vietnam. My great-great-grandma, so my grandma's mom, couldn't walk any further. And the family had left her behind in a tree. She asked to just be left behind. So she died in the forest on the way to Vietnam. And then they go to Vietnam and they're trying to reestablish themselves. They had some run-ins with the Viet Cong knocking on the doors, trying to find any men, young men, to join the battle against the Americans, American government. And so from my understanding, they left Vietnam in order to escape the Viet Cong.
That is an unbelievable story. Holy cow. They yeah. must be really happy to be in the United States.
Oh, yeah, totally. To the point where they, you know, mistake a lot of the prosperity they've experienced here with the U.S. government and saying, okay, well, we're so safe and taken care of by the U.S. government here. This government's okay.
Isn't that interesting? They would, because yeah. I think a lot of listeners would think they would have the opposite view because of what they'd gone through.
Yeah. They have some mistrust, but at the end of, like, I've pried my mom mostly on it, but at the end of the day, she like excused taxation because she felt like it would give her security. But I've since then pried her and, you know, explained to her that taxation is theft, and we had conversations about it, and it like hit her, and she was like, whoa, you're right. And I could tell she was a little frightened by that reality.
Well, I could imagine going through something as traumatic as that and thinking, you know, I'm so glad to be in a place where I have problems, but they're problems on rather a different scale than living under the Khmer Rouge. Yeah. I might not think in terms of philosophy. I may just think, thank God I'm here, and just go from there.
Yeah.
Now, let's jump right into something highly controversial, because the alt-right out there argues that philosophy in general or libertarian principles, these are just empty husks. There's nothing to them in that nobody fights for these principles. Nobody cares about principle. Like you were saying, for example, that your family may have endured racism. And by the way, I've mentioned on the show that in Malaysia, the Malaysian constitution actually has anti-Chinese discrimination, or at least at one time, written into it in terms of how much property they could own, industries they could go into, things like that. I mean, there were quota systems for the native Malaysian people against the Chinese. So I don't dispute that at all. But the point is, that goes to show that people think tribalistically, that, for example, we could talk all day long about repealing regulations, but the guy who actually seems to be accomplishing it is the guy who, rightly or wrongly, is perceived to have sent a message of tribalism, or at least that there's nothing wrong with being an American, being American in the majority, let's say, you know, who doesn't have any hyphenated affiliations. And that is sweeping Europe, whereas our dry, boring ideas, let's go read Mises' Human Action, doesn't get that kind of traction with the public. And so when you're just a voice crying in the wilderness when you're talking about philosophy that's separated from this lived reality of real people in real cultures. So that's the critique that they've been offering. So I wonder, as somebody who you yourself spend your time talking about just abstract ideas, what do you think about that proposition?
Okay, so the proposition that the only way to affect change is to appeal to people's tribalistic and collectivist nature.
Because nobody cares. No, the point is that nobody, if you were to stand up here and say, I believe in self-ownership, half the people who voted for Trump, for example, would already be asleep. They couldn't care less about your principle. What they care for is a guy who says, I'm here to represent you. Well, I'm just playing devil's advocate. I mean, I do exactly the same thing you do. Right. You look at all my YouTube videos, every last one of them is me talking about abstract principles. So I have kind of a vested interest in the outcome of this debate here.
Right, exactly. Well, what I would say to them is, first I would just question, you know, what are their statistics for that? Like, how are they determining that? Are they just looking at anecdotal, you know, evidence? But I would say that the principles that we advocate for is not abstract, because they're practically applicable. As long as you apply the principles consistently, the argument is that it will result in maximum freedom and minimal coercion. So to them, I would say that, you know, instead of appealing to people's tribalistic nature, you challenge them, you figure out how to communicate best to people, empathize with them to get through to them, and also look to people who have changed, that went from normie to voluntarist, just like you, you know, and try and figure out what was the thing that triggered them to change. And of course, it's a long-term process. You'll see that if you look at anyone who has changed, it took them years. It took them years of just being exposed to different ideas. I like to call them liberty seeds. And eventually, one day it clicks for them. So to them, I would say, you know, if your goal is to reach a world of freedom, of maximum freedom, that you would analyze what causes people to change, and also analyze what made people the way they are now.
Well, that leads to another question I want to ask. I guess my point was that I think a lot of people respond better to, hey, that guy is standing up for my interests, than they do to, that guy believes in universally applicable principles for everybody. And I wish it were otherwise, because that's what I'm trying to do. And somebody comes along kind of with the, you know, look, I don't even have a well thought out philosophy, but I just think you're getting screwed by these globalists, and they go for it.
Yeah.
And I get up there and say, but look, you know, there's a lot more to it than that. These people who are supposedly protecting you are also screwing you over. You know, listen.
Yeah, but, definitely.
Yeah, anyway, so the two things that come right to mind to ask somebody who produces as much content as you do is I'd like to know two different things. First, of all the different videos or articles you've written, I'd like to know which one generated the most pushback. And secondly, which one or which argument, not even necessarily on your in your writing or your videos, but it could just be in your day-to-day interactions with people, mm-hmm. which kind of approach has worked the best by contrast?
Okay. So I guess I'll look at your first question. Which one has generated the most controversy or pushback? I would say the taxation is theft one. I mean, I could say the gun control myth debunked one. But yeah, it's mostly the taxation is theft one has gotten pushback from both the so-called, you know, left and right. So that one, because you're looking straight at, you know, the core of things and the nature of government, that tends to trigger both sides. So I'd say that one has had the most pushback. and then what was your other question?
What approach or what argument or overall approach has generated the most success for you?
Oh,
in thinking, getting people to think differently.
For me, the approach is just focusing on the core principles and trying to reiterate them. So just always bringing it back to what is the nature of government, or when people advocate for government to do something, breaking it down for the reality of what is being advocated for. I've noticed that with some people that can help them to realize, whoa, okay, I didn't realize I was actually advocating for that, or it gives them another lens of seeing reality than they had previously seen it.
You're at 70,000 Facebook fans or whatever that we're supposed to call them these days,
yeah,
on your page.
Just passed it.
Yeah, yeah. And that's not because of some, you know, you bought some software that automates, you know, likes or anything like that. And I don't think you've had like a, you know, you haven't hired a social media specialist. I mean, 70,000 is a very, very respectable, more than respectable number.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
How do you account for that? I mean, you know, there are libertarians who have way more than that. That's true. But
yeah.
I mean, you're talking about somebody who you do this in your spare time. This is not your full-time gig. You don't have a team of people helping you. As far as I know, it's just you. And there you are. You have a really, really nice community.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, in terms of help, I do have a lot of friends in the Liberty movement, a lot of fellow meme makers, like a lot of the Anarchy Ball admins. They have helped me with some memes. But yeah, I would say that what accounts for it is it's been a very slow growth. I started this summer of 2016. So it'll have been 2 years. Well, yeah, it's actually, this is the second year of really Philosopher since I started videos. Philosopher was up and running for like 6 months prior to that. A lot of it was just slow growth. I would get a wave of likes depending on which video I released. One of the first ones that gave me a huge growing was the first video I did, which was the nature of gun control. Just speaking to what gun control is really about. And that brought in a, you know, influx of either patriotic, you know, Second Amendment supporters. They're not necessarily ANCAPs, but they love guns. They understand the right to self-defense and self-ownership in some way. They just don't apply it, you know, all the way to the state. So that was one. That was a big hit. Another one that was huge, which really grew my, grew my following, was when I produced a video for Being Libertarian. I had it hosted there on their page, and they had like 400,000 likes at the time. So that was a huge audience, the hugest audience I'd ever had. So Taxation is Theft just went viral. I think that crossed like 2 million views. So that was really cool. And that brought in like 10K likes.
Yeah. See, now that's critical, isn't it? To really leverage other people's audiences, yes. other people who want to help you, who like what you're saying. So it's not like you're doing anything underhanded. But yeah. wow, does that give you a nice boost?
Exactly. And you're right. So what would account for it is a lot of it is I've had help with Anarchy Ball. They were very gracious. They liked my memes. They liked my videos and my content. So I shared a lot to Anarchy Ball as well. And so that was a huge part of growing the fan base. And then from there, you know, after getting a sizable amount, the next videos I did that increased my virality was the video I did where it was three gun control myths debunked. Basically anything about guns tends to go very viral. I think because it really hits to the core of people's emotions about preserving their own life. I mean, when it comes to liberty, preserving your own life is one of the tenets, you know? So it really strikes a chord with people, and it's a very emotionally charged argument on both sides. So yeah, so that was the next wave. And right now I just kind of continue to make memes on different things, still focusing on principles. But if there's, you know, some big thing happening in the news, then I'll make a meme. And I noticed that focusing on current events is one of the big increases of an audience as well, because usually when people are on social media, their interest tends to be whatever's the hugest event, you know, in the mainstream news. Right. And yeah, if there's a big debate going on, that's a very good thing to cover as well. And to be able to give your own voice to a situation that's happening, I found is very effective in terms of growing your audience and your reach.
Have you found video really is king as a medium when it comes to increasing likes and audience size?
No, actually, it depends. Video can be very good, but it has to be, it depends on the platform as well. So like Facebook is really specific. If you have like big block titles, captions, which is what I learned to do, very quick video. Like if you notice, my videos are at most like 7 minutes, but I try to keep it under three because, you know, people are scrolling through Facebook. Their attention can be taken away really quickly. So you have to grab their attention. But I would say memes are king when it comes to virality, honestly. Because memes, if you think about it, you know, depending on, of course, how you make the meme, there are some really poor memes out there. But, you know, they stand out. They're quick, they're consumable, you know, in one instance, and with people who have short attention span or a variety of interests, it can grab their attention right away. And the goal really is to, and I do this in videos too, is to create a controversy and then have a bunch of debates in the comments. That's kind of been my rhythm of business, you could say. So I wouldn't say video is king more than memes. I think it just depends on the meme and the video, but I would say they both are very important.
All right. I'm sorry I'm getting into the technical details and the weeds of this, but it really interests me. Just one last sort of technical question.
Yeah.
When you make a video and you put it on Facebook, you wouldn't embed a YouTube video in Facebook. You would make the video as a Facebook video?
Yeah, exactly.
But would you also have it on YouTube?
Yes, I do. Okay. And it's different.
But it works better that way. It works better. Like it gets more, Facebook is more generous about getting it out on people's feeds if it's a Facebook video. Yeah,
definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, they don't really, they kind of kill the reach on external links.
Yeah.
And, you know, it makes sense.
But I wasn't sure because I thought that in general, although they don't like a link to a blog post or something, I've learned that, they do seem, they like video better, but apparently they like their own homegrown
Yes.
locally hosted video even better still. Okay. All right. Well, I just want to know for the future because I may try and get back into making videos. When you look at my videos on YouTube, the vast majority of them, I have twice as much hair as I have now. I'm not gray at all. So it's going to shock people when I burst back onto the video scene. They're saying, what the hell happened to him? But anyway.
Are you really? You're going to make, I don't know if you know, but you're also one of the first people that helped me to become a voluntarist, particularly because I found out about you on Stefan Molyneux's show. So I'm also a fan of yours.
Oh, thanks.
And so, wait, you're going to make videos again?
Well, I haven't for a while because I thought, well, look, I have a podcast. But for me, videos always just did so well, and I think they did increase the listenership. So thing is, over the summer, I travel a lot, so it's going to be hard to start this over the summer. But maybe the end of the summer. Yeah, I mean, I might start making a few simple videos. And one thing that's really made this easier for me is that in the old days, I had this unbelievable setup in my office where I had these huge lights that looked like I was, you know, in a TV studio, and I had this Pro-Am camera that I had just so, and I had this, lapel mic plugged into it and all that. But now my Mac webcam that's built into this thing, which in the old days, that just screamed out amateur. If you were using you looked blue or green. Lighting was awful. This thing, without any special lighting set up at all, so I don't have to clutter my office anymore, it looks beautiful. So, and now I have a USB lapel mic, and I am ready to go. And so it makes it so much easier. And now that it's so much easier, I can justify doing it. It's not going to be this ordeal of, oh, now there's glare on the back of the desk. Now I got to go. Yeah. It was such a pain in the old days. All right. So I'm glad. So tell me, how about this one?
My friend, sorry.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I just want to give you some advice, if I may.
Yeah, sure.
When you want to start uploading videos directly to YouTube, I noticed something that could be good, especially for someone who does podcasts, is taking, you know, a snippet of something you say that's like really powerful, and especially if you're recording video, that is even better. But probably have somebody, you know, create a block title, make it huge and to the point of what it is, and then, you know, have a shorter video. And I found that that can go more viral just because it's short. People's eyes are drawn into the big block letters. Especially if the title is controversial, that's even better. Just a little.
That's very good advice. Obviously, Molyneux is doing very well with those big block titles as the still image for the video. So I definitely want to look into that.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, here's the next question I want to ask you. My friend Ben Settle is in the world of email copywriting. Now, a lot of people will hear that and they'll think that he copyrights emails. No. Copywriting, W-R-I-T-I-N-G. He writes email copy that sells in different niches. Okay. Uh-huh. So he'll, you know, there'll be some golf company and they want somebody to write an email for them that will sell golf products. And Ben is the expert at that, or one of the experts at that. And recently he copied this from somebody else, but he's been doing on his podcast, his personal Mount Rushmore. And for each of four episodes, he's taken one person in his field who's really influenced him and devoted an episode to that person. So I wonder who is on your personal Mount Rushmore for libertarian ANCAP voluntarist ideas.
Okay.
And by the way, you said a nice thing about me. I'm going to ask that you exclude me so there's no appearance of favoritism here. So who would be in your personal Mount Rushmore?
Mine would be, I have three that come immediately to mind. It would be Stefan Molyneux. He's like the main influence, especially his much earlier videos since he started for like 10 years of his initial career with Freedom Main Radio. So Stefan Molyneux. The second is Adam Kokesh. Him and Stefan Molyneux used to have more of a relationship or public relationship together. So I found out about Adam Kokesh, and I've always appreciated how he's maintained his focus on principles. And the third person would be the creator of the Voluntarist comic series. He's become one of my best friends. And yeah, I just look up to all three of them for people who have been focused on the principles of philosophy and liberty, and also understand what it takes to compose a good argument, use reason and evidence, speak to people nonviolently, and the importance of self-knowledge and things like that. So all three of them have been my personal, I guess you could say, Mount Rushmore, or just people that I've admired and looked up to.
Would you say it's fair to say that the taxation is theft argument has figured fairly heavily into some of your public stuff?
Yeah, definitely fair to say.
Okay, all right. So What do you say when somebody comes, and this is going to be a super original argument you've never heard before, when somebody comes back with, but taxation funds necessary services?
What would I say?
Yeah.
Oh, I would, yeah, you're right. I've never heard this one before.
it's a whole new world you encounter here.
Yeah. I would say that it doesn't matter what the robber used your money for. If the robber used the money that he stole from you to pay for your health care, it doesn't change that he initially stole from you. So yeah, that's what I would say. Just kind of breaking down the reality there.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I don't think it would be the case that if somebody broke into your house but promised to put all the stuff they took to good use, you'd say, well, look, I mean, I wasn't really using the stuff. I mean, this person is pretty sure he's found something better.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Right. You got to think that way because it goes to show that when you don't think that way, you're privileging the state in a way you would privilege no other institution. You give it the benefit of the doubt. You make up preposterous arguments for it. You're willing to look the other way at moral enormities that if anybody you knew was doing, you would say, my God, this is a sociopath I can't have anything to do with.
Yeah.
So that's a key thing. I had Keith Knight on not too long ago. He made this amazing 5-hour ANCAP video. Now, it's not just his talking head for 5 hours. He took his favorite clips. Apparently, he's been doing a lot of video watching of ANCAPs talking. Mm-hmm. He stitched them together and he said, all right, look, not everybody's going to sit through 5 hours, but it's the kind of thing that when you have that friend who's just on the edge, they start tuning in. They say, all right, I'll watch a few minutes just to humor my friend.
Yeah.
But, they're bleary-eyed the next morning. They've been up all night watching this 5-hour video. But one of his things really has been emphasizing just the double standards that we accept. Well, we reject certain ideas, certain practices when we see them in the private sector, but when the government does them, it's like we don't even we forgot what we just said about what that would mean in the private sector.
So exactly.
Is this also a way that you're getting to people? Because it's very powerful, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Really, another thing that tying it back to one of the ways that I've helped to change people's minds and is bringing it back to principles and pointing out the nature of government. But yeah, kind of what you're saying and Keith is trying to expose is people have this false dichotomy of moral actors. They have, on the one hand, they think, theft is wrong, murder is wrong. But if it's done by the state, they create this separate moral category. And I call it a false dichotomy because both are made up of human beings. So they're creating two separate groups of people who are actually just the same when it boiling down to the individual. So I've found that to be very effective. And when people say, government should do this or government is needed for that, giving an example and applying what they're advocating for to other situations that, pretty sure unless they're just so corrupt, they would, realize, oh, wait, I actually don't agree with it in this situation. So pointing that out there has been really helpful. And the false dichotomy that they have of different moral agents.
I know one person who is willing to accept the taxation as theft argument. Mm-hmm. But then he goes out long and says, but we need some theft, apparently, for civilization. So yeah, I get that I'm being inconsistent in favoring it, but it's either that or Lord of the Flies or whatever. And so once you get through the philosophy, then unfortunately you wind up having to come up with all, I don't mean unfortunately, I mean, it's great to engage in intellectual exchanges like this, but it's not enough to win that debate because some people might say, all right, I get that in the abstract, I'm doing something wrong, but practically speaking, I don't see how to avoid doing that wrong thing. And then you have to get into, well, here's how the legal system would work it just never seems to end.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. That's just kind of what it takes. The indoctrination is so heavy.
Those are legitimate questions because it is hard to understand.
It is.
Although, even for the same people who see how easy it is to understand that the supply of food does seem to work. Like we're all you know, we're not starving by and large, and that's handled mm-hmm. for the most part in the private sector. Mm-hmm. And you would think food is necessary to life itself. I mean, forget courts and whatever else. You can't go to court if you're not alive. Yes. And yet somehow we're being fed all right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what's the problem with the court thing? But it's easy to see why people would have a problem with that. Well, wouldn't we just have warring factions? But the thing is, you could easily imagine people in all kinds of situations where the private sector is in charge. If the private sector weren't in charge, they'd have all kinds of fantasy reasons why that couldn't work. Well, if mm-hmm. if the private sector were providing shoes, well, maybe one company would provide only left shoes and the other company would provide, but then you have to ask yourself, why would they?
Exactly.
Nobody wants that. Yeah. Why would they do that? Or if the private sector provides batteries, well, every company will have a different size battery. But why? The consumer wouldn't want – why would you think they would do that?
Yeah,
and then as soon as you say, no, they would all figure out together what size battery the consumer wants best. They'd say, oh, you're naive. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not naive because that's in fact what happens in the actual world we live in.
Ah, yeah. I'm glad you said that because I was going to bring up the other thing I was going to say is helping people to look at and think in a compared to what manner. I mean, that's one of the things, one of the tenets of philosophy is understanding that when you make a statement, it's always compared to what, you know, like I like you, it's always compared to what. Of course, you don't really ask that, but that is the underlying thing. So when, you know, most times, I mean, like 9 times out of 10, if someone says, well, how would an anarchist society handle this? Like, legal services, you can just point out, well, compared to what is now, let's look at that. And you'll see that there's already private arbitration agencies. There's already private defense. There's, you know, a lot of private road building, governments who say they use your taxes for the roads, yet they charge you tolls. You know, you can already just look at what is now. It almost feels just so simple understanding that and after having learned about it, but I can speak to my own, you know, normie self and normie mindset, where when I first became a voluntarist, I did it out of principle. I realized, okay, down to the individual level, I don't want to initiate force against anyone. And I remember the feeling, you know, as a child growing up and having my own consent violated or my own will violated. And embodying that. And that's when I became a voluntarist. But I still had those questions of, I remember in the beginning just being like, well, but then if there's no government, who's going to defend me? What about the police? There'll be no police. And I just like, you know, I can empathize to people I talk to now, statists, basically, not in a derogatory term, just they just, you know, they believe in the state. And I can empathize with that underlying fear, because that's really what it is, the underlying fear of the unknown, fear of chaos, that fear of chaos that's instilled in you in public school, the desire for safety and security. These are very human and kind of universal emotions and desire. So I can empathize with that.
How do people follow you?
Oh, sure. Well, the biggest following is on Facebook. So if you have a Facebook account, although I know a lot of people have deleted it, but you can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Steemit if you're into, you know, decentralized social media platforms, Minds, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube.
Oh my gosh, that's ridiculous. Okay.
Yeah, it's a lot to manage. But you can find all the links on my website. It's just The Philosopher. Just how you spell it, oneword.com.
All right. All that stuff, or at least a few of those, and then your website for the rest will be linked at tomwoods.com/1185. All right. Well, thanks for your time today. It's interesting to talk to somebody so mysterious. I don't even know your full name. But good for you. It's not holding you back any. You're doing a great job, and we're glad you're out there doing it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Tom. And I usually just say my name for people that I get to know, so I've met you in person already at your Tom Woods event, so feel free to call me.
Thank you. And I didn't say, by the way, that you had been at the 1,000th episode because I didn't want to, you know, even that, you know, maybe somebody saw you. I don't even know.
True.
So, but yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that because what a great time we had at that thing.
Yeah. Oh, so fun. And thanks for that short video you let me record of us.
Oh, I recorded that video for you at that event too. Now, by the way, I just for people out there who didn't get to the 1,000th episode, you now know, and if you haven't listened to the 1,000th, go to tomwoods.com/1,000 because you've got to either listen to that or better yet, watch the YouTube video that's on that page.
Yes.
And you're going to say to yourself, when that 2,000th episode or whatever it is comes up, I got to be there. And here's the thing. I know this has nothing to do with anything. This has nothing to do with anything, but I can't do it during hurricane season again. That's the problem. And the problem is
that
you know, since every year of episode, you know, every 250 episodes or so lands me back in September again, the 2000th episode would be smack dab in the middle of hurricane season. So I have to figure, it's got to be some weirdo number episode that nevertheless has some significance. It could be a year. I mean, I'm not going to do something hackneyed like 1776, but it's got to be something that gets me off 2000 so I don't have another hurricane that screws up my plans. But that is not your concern. Your concern is getting people to listen to the good stuff you're putting out, and I hope people will do that by going to your website and or checking out tomwoods.com/1185. All right, now for sure, I'm going to let you go and say thanks again.
Thanks, Tom. Happy to talk to you.
All right, that's our show for today. We mentioned guns today a bit on the episode, so make sure, of course, you have your copy of my free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Guns. Just the title alone should make you want to download that thing. Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Guns is available over at wrongaboutguns.com. See you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.